Welcome to an all-new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I am Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. Be a little bit of a quicker episode by our standards here today. Just us, no guests rolling on in, but we will have some fantastic guests coming back here soon. We're basically just going to take this time to go over the games that happened last week and then have a little debate, try to figure out who the four most likely double bye teams are right now. But Matt, before we get into this, because they didn't play any games that were particularly super notable, but I want to shout out the St. Joe's Hawks because they might be the story of the week. 3 wins in 8 days after starting 0-4 and looking like they were on a path straight towards last place.
I just checked it out. This is the second 3-game winning streak of the last 4 years for the Hawks. So this is impressive stuff.
And I assume that includes non-conference as well.
It includes everything. The last time this happened was the last 3 games of the regular season in 2021, right when Ryan Daly came back. And then they beat LaSalle too in the pillow fight. So that was actually 4 in a row. But yeah, the Hawks are playing some good basketball and suddenly they don't seem like a lock to make the pillow fight. I don't know. It's an uphill battle, but
right now they're only in it by tiebreaker.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to avoid it, though, with 6 teams heading there this year. But, I mean, as we're going to talk about later on in this episode, the standings are just a jumbled mess, and there's so many things that could happen. There's so many tiebreakers going on. It's not even really worth figuring out, but I mean, that was a good win against, albeit a struggling UMass team this week, where St. Joe's protected their home court and they kept the winning ways.
Yeah, and I want to throw some shout-outs the way of a few players here. First and foremost is Cam Brown, who I sold all my stock in. Like, this was a guy that I really liked as a potential star for years. And kind of wrote him off by the end of last year. Figured he was somewhere around a mediocre starter. That's what he showed us the first 3 years of his career. And he really didn't improve along the way. Well, it's on a lesser scale. I'm not saying that he's as good as him, but this is very similar to what we saw with Vince Williams last year over at VCU. Just a very nice role player who, by the time his coach got the right lineup clicking together in the regular season, ended up playing like a star to finish out his career. 25, 20, and 25 points in 3 of his last 4 games. He only had 4 in the win over Loyola, but Billy Lang yanked his starters pretty quick in that one. And right now, he's on a path straight towards an all-conference team. I would say right now, if we were putting it together for the first third of the season, he'd be on the second team. If he continues to play this way and St. Joe's can simply avoid probably the bottom 3 in the standings, he's going to be on an all-conference team when things come to an end because his numbers are about as good as Eric Reynolds at this point.
And I think the best part of this, both for him and St. Joe's, just think about how few 4-year players are left in the conference right now. And after how the last 3 years went, it would have been so easy for Cam Brown to say, like, to heck with this, I'm on a bad team. Like, he's good enough that he either could have transferred down and been a superstar in a low major, or he would have been good enough to get some minutes at a high major school. But he wrote it out at St. Joe's, and right now he's playing the best basketball of his career. So that has been exciting.
If it was a basketball-only decision, he would have been gone. Clearly, there's either a connection to the university as a whole or to Billy Lang, because basketball-wise, it actually did make no sense for him to come back. I think you could put him on a good high-major team, and he's their 8th man, but he does all those things that you want from your 3rd guy off the bench very, very well. So he's someone that I think could fit in on just name any, basically, tournament team that's between a 5 and a 12 seed right now. But the biggest change for St. Joe's has been their other senior, Educate Obina, who got sent to the bench early in the season. Now, granted, he wasn't playing that well himself, but Billy Lang wanted more floor spacing out of the center spot. And ever since Obina's come into the starting lineup, St. Joe's defense has gone from horrific to passable. And with the fact that they're shooting the ball extremely well right now, passable is enough to get some wins.
I'm starting to feel like with Obina getting back to his old self last year, the Hawks starting five isn't bad. I think the issue is they have no depth because really Rashear Fleming's the only guy doing anything off the bench right now.
Winborn has an incredible game, like one out of every four, but then two of those other three, he does nothing. So,
Yeah, I think the starting lineup can hang with most teams in the conference if they're having a good night. There's not a ton of depth behind that, but I mean, yeah, with Obina playing well and Cameron Brown suddenly becoming one of the better players in this league, the Hawks are looking much better than a few weeks ago. So we'll see where they can go from here.
yeah, and look, if we really wanted to sit down and try to figure out how do we rank these teams just purely on talent? St. Joe's is not at the bottom by any stretch. They're way better than LaSalle. I think they have significantly more talent than Rhode Island or Loyola. I think they're actually very close with some teams that are currently above them in the standings, like Fordham and St. Bonaventure. They might have more skill if we're just out on a playground than any of those teams.
Yeah, I think you're missing a few too,
Yeah,
honestly.
well, I skipped some of the other pillow fighters. Like, yeah, I
I mean,
mean, they're better than, I already said LaSalle. I'm trying to think of who I'm missing
I
here.
think
I
Davidson.
think they're probably about the same as UMass, honestly.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
But the one other guy is Lynn Greer, who really just not doing anything in the scoring department until late. 6 of 10 against Loyola, including five made threes, and then shot 5 of 9 against LaSalle. He's become kind of a triple nickel god at this point.
He's got three of them this year.
He's racked up, he has four in conference play.
I might have missed one.
And
But
UMass,
he's right there.
he was one assist and 1 point short. So, oh, sorry, he only had 4 points against Fordham. So, yes, you're correct. He only has three.
Yeah, I think he's one behind another Philly point guard, Khalil Brantley. So those two guys, it seems like they might be going for the crown this year after the A-10 lost a ton of triple nickel gods the last couple of years with Jordan Goodwin. Yuri Collins hasn't even gotten any this year
I
from St.
feel like
Joe's,
we've lost Noah
but
Fernandes at this point,
he isn't
so
getting any.
he's literally
Yeah,
just not
weirdly,
playing
Matt
anymore.
Cross has become the UMass triple nickel guy. I would have thought Fernandes and Yuri Collins would be leading the way this year, but that just hasn't worked out. Collins has two, I think, but not keeping up. It's just assists for him.
But Lynn Greer, he's basically like a perfect 1981 point guard. He's a wonderful passer. He's one of the smartest guys out on the court, if not the smartest in basically every game. And he's a strong defender. But the way Billy Lang runs this offense, he needs to score for this team. And this was really the first time all year that he showed that ability against quality competition. In his other best scoring nights, game against a terrible Albany team, he had 19. He got to 15 against South Florida and 14 against Villanova, two games where they were just getting killed all the way through. Like the game that he had against LaSalle was the first time all season where he was able to just consistently put the ball in the hoop in a competitive game against a decent team.
And the guy we haven't even talked about, Eric Reynolds, is averaging 18 points a game, but he's been scoring a bunch all season.
Well,
And
because he's just kind of been doing this all year. Everyone else has gotten better around
but
Reynolds.
when he's doing it by himself, that's proven to not be enough for St. Joe's to win games. They need Greer, they need Brown, and these other guys to
They need
step up too.
Casper, who we shouted out last week. So
We can shout
we'll
him out
pass him
every
by.
week. All-Fun team honorary. or honorable mention, I believe.
He was the Polish Kelly Olynyk, and then he cut the man bun, and it kind of doesn't work anymore. But they're the same. They're well, relative to the guys he's playing against, they're the same size. In reality, Olynyk's about 3 inches taller, but just basically a rebounder, corner three shooter who can get to the rim. And he looked like Olynyk before the haircut, so I'm really bummed about that. That's actually why he doesn't deserve the shout out.
No, I mean, that's what the All Fun team's about. It's intangibles in addition to fun play. But hey, I mean, he's sort of a point forward that St. Joe's always wants to have. And he's getting better at least. I'm still glad, like, after last year where he just barely played and had all these injuries, he's become closer to what the hype was talking about last year.
So, well, I want to end it with this because this threw me off. Is St. Joe's in the top 200 in KenPom either defensively or offensively?
I feel like offensively they should be, but I don't have it in front of me.
They're not because they still sh their shooting percentages on the year are still horrible.
Oh, wow.
Because
They're
they,
better
sh
on defense. Wow.
yeah, they are better. On KenPom defensively, now it's pretty close, but I mean, this team was a defensive atrocity basically until these 3 games. Duquesne, their offense played great and they lost because they could not stop the Dukes really one time down the court. But here we are, 55 against Loyola, 59 against LaSalle, 68 against UMass. This might be the best defensive week of the entirety of Billy Lang's tenure.
Probably is. I mean, they have turned a corner in that regard. And I still think offensively, like, they're not a bad 3-point shooting team. They probably take a few too many,
They're
but
slightly above average overall because they've
yeah.
had a few really hot games lately that's brought them up a lot.
They still don't really have, like, Obina is getting better, but they still don't really have much of a true interior presence that's gonna scare you offensively.
The only bummer about all this, and this leads us into the biggest game of the week, but St. Joe's defense is playing the best it has all year. So is GW's. And they play each other on Wednesday. And as a fan, I kind of hope that both of those trends just go by the wayside for this. Because if they both get back to playing poor defense simultaneously with the scoring that they both have and the pace that they want to play at, we could be talking like a 95-92 incredible shootout here. And so, selfishly, I really hope that both defenses go back to their horrible days for this one.
Yeah, that's going to be up tempo too. That those teams both like to run, so we could potentially that could be one of the highest scoring games of the conference season. KenPom's got it at 79-74, which I don't know if the defense goes back to what we were seeing earlier in the season. That's too low.
Yeah, I really want Reynolds plus Brown and Adams plus Bishop to both get over 50 in that game. Just watch those four just basically go at each other for 40 minutes.
Well, that's not what happened in GW's last game. So I think we need to talk a little bit about what they did to date, just completely suffocating the Flyers. It ended up 76-69, but there were a ton of free throws late in the game. A bad beat, too. Like the over just finally hit in the last 20 seconds or so. But Dayton was really struggling from the field. Both inside, you had Daron Holmes going 5 for 15 from the floor. And then outside, the Flyers couldn't hit open threes the whole game. And meanwhile, on the other end, James Bishop was just cooking all afternoon, getting free, getting to the rim, and hitting plenty of tough shots. So, really impressive performance for GW. And as we speak right now, the Colonials are in fourth place.
So, I got to go back and watch this game under the perspective of already knowing that GW dominated and won because I was out of the house for this. And I came away with two really main points, one super surprising, one not. I'll hit the unsurprising one first. And it's something that we've talked about before, but very, very briefly. Dayton really struggles defensively against the top of the line elite speed guards. Funny enough, you knock it down a half of a notch and they're fantastic. They shut down Day-Day Grant. They played great defense against Brendan Adams from the field in this game. In the second half, they started hacking him, but he didn't score the first 15 minutes. Those are guys who are quick, but not super fast. James Bishop and Maximus Edwards are super fast. And immediately out of the gate, they killed these guys. This is exactly what NC State did to them, too. Where Terquavion Smith and whatever the hell that point guard's name is, we're just going past guys. And this whole Dayton defense is so dependent on either keeping your man in front of you, or if you don't, everyone rotates as fast as they can. And when you're facing Foster Lawyer, who's a think through it point guard and not a beat you off the dribble point guard, you can rotate and recover very easily. When it's Maximus Edwards bursting to the rim, you can't do that. And GW just time and time again crushed him doing that.
Well, and part of it too with James Bishop is just that his decision making's gotten so much better this year. And when he was blowing by defenders on his way to the basket, he didn't always need to worry about getting blocked by Holmes or Kamara because he had 7 assists. He was hitting guys on back cuts. He had Hunter Dean for a few dunks inside. And yeah, as soon as Bishop or whoever else, if Edwards was able to penetrate, they were just getting wide open looks at the rim the whole afternoon.
Yeah, and I want to throw it out here because the nickname has been lingering kind of obviously all year. But Maximus Edwards, he's earned it. You can't get this cool of a nickname until you've proven to us that you are a beast. And it's time that we refer to him as the Gladiator for the rest of the year.
So we might be referring to him as the rookie of the year.
I think
He's,
we will, at this moment, I think we will be.
I think he's
We'll see if
heading
he
that
holds
way.
it together. But these books need to get odds out for random mid-major awards. But if I had to estimate, I'd say Maximus Edwards is probably around a minus 150 favorite. But he should be the favorite at the moment.
Don't know. Well, if you want a long shot bet. So I don't think anywhere you can find those sort of odds. Probably not for any conference, but definitely not a mid-major. Regular season title odds, you can get GW, or at least you could get them a couple days ago at 250-1 to win the A-10. So if you feel like a lottery ticket
Yes.
on one of the better, like hotter teams in the conference right now,
There's
they're
still just a
at the very
little
least.
too much Diamond Head stench still on this
I
team.
mean, 250-1 though, where we're talking about a one bid league most likely. You never know what could happen, but at the
If
very
they'd beaten
least,
St. Louis when Jiri was out, we could have had that conversation.
I'll say this: I think GW is my favorite team to watch, just in terms of how much I enjoy their games and the entertainment factor, especially Bishop and Edwards. But overall, it just their style of play offensively. What I love efficiency, and the fact that they are one of the best 2-point shooting teams in the country is it's just fun basketball, and they compete at a much higher level than last year with a lot of the same guys, but they're just smarter on the court. They share the ball more, and it's gotten them really good results too.
I mean, my favorite niche watch this year is Richmond, but GW is not far off. The other key piece of this, Tatum shot 27 threes. Why? How? Like, and it's a credit to Chris Caputo here, who did exactly what VCU did to start off the game, sending hard doubles at Holmes every time he had the ball. And early in the game, he didn't want to force anything. He was just kind of quickly kicking it out. In the VCU game, Dayton adjusted. This time they didn't. And they basically were happy to just let the guards try to create on their own and take a bunch of jump shots. And the analogy that just kept ringing through my head for this game, Anthony Grant went to go play a game of blackjack at Bally's. Caputo was the dealer. He's showing a face card. And Grant just decided to hold on 12 the whole time. And in the end, it turned out Caputo probably turned over a 7. Like, it was a really good strategy. It was a great game plan from him. But if Dayton had bothered to adjust, they could have beaten it. We saw them beat it in the VCU game. That's where all those Tumani Kamara dribble drives came from. But, like, Dayton just kind of had no interest in attacking the rim. And we haven't really seen that since the Wisconsin disaster. That's a really bad sign. Like,
and part of it, too, just knowing who you're up against, like, for all the compliments I just gave GW, they're still not a good defensive team, and especially they don't protect the rim very well at all.
Well, Lindo and Dean do a decent job of it, but GW's biggest weakness on their entire roster is if you make those guys work hard and either get them tired or get them in foul trouble, their defense is flat out putrid when those guys are off the court. Like, that's what happened right before Diamond Head and early in that tournament when Hunter Dean was hurt. They're just giving up points at the rim in bunches.
And not only that, too, but GW out-rebounded Dayton, which, yeah, looking at the stats, you never would have expected
it can't
that.
Can't happen. Like, we can go team by team and compare it. Dayton shouldn't lose the rebounding battle to anyone in this conference.
Yeah, especially not GW. That would be one of the last teams I would have expected. But I think that was also just a testament to GW's effort. You could tell they wanted it, both with their play on the court and also the fans getting into the game, too.
And I wonder if there was maybe a little extra motivation for this one, because GW got annihilated by Dayton both times they played them last year. Like, if you had only watched GW twice last year from the perspective of those two Dayton games, you would have thought they were the worst team in the country. I think they lost them both by 25 plus and were down by at least 30 at points in both of those games. This game, they came out hot from the beginning. They never relinquished that lead.
Oh, and really, we could say GW hasn't even had a game like that in conference play. They lost to Richmond by 10 on the road, but like never let the game get out of hand. And then St. Louis by 7. So they've competed in all 6 conference games, and we can't say that about last year. Even though they finished around 500, they got blown out several times throughout the year.
They're better this year. They might end up with a worse seed, but they're better this year. That team won so many dumb, fluky games that just with how this team moves the ball now, they kind of don't get the benefit of the doubt of the night where Bishop just goes for like 42 and they win because of that. That's what carried them through last season. So, and one of the other big things from this game, the student section at the Charles Entertainment Smith Center just seemed to be rocking again. The noise was coming through the TV. It was packed through the gills. And we're excited to announce that we're going to hit the road here in a few weeks and go down to the Entertainment Center and CGW take on Duquesne. And funny enough, you had pitched the idea of heading down to a GW game back when we saw the schedule initially. And honestly, I kind of tried to just deflect from it. It was maybe dead last on my list going into the season of arenas I wanted to see this year, just because it had been dead the last few years and the product wasn't very good. But things have turned around quick, and it seems like a really fun place, and I think we got to go see it for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this year it's been a little bit of a throwback to the old days, like the mid-2000s, when GW had one of the best home court advantages in the conference. And as disgusted as I was over the weekend, I was getting a kick out of every time GW went on a little run. You'd see our friend Ryan Paleo out there wearing his construction hat, making a lot of noise. I mean, every time they would just cut to the fans, GW did something, and that was great. One other fan, too, I want to shout out. Just overall a great weekend for the fans. But over at Shea Fitz Arena, we got the return of LaSalle Gumby, perched right behind Fran Dunphy and the Explorers bench. He had a great time, even though it wasn't a very good game for LaSalle. Good to see him back. I mean, I think those two guys are neck and neck in the fan of the year voting.
Yeah, I mean, the Gumby guy is great. We just kind of forget about him because we only see him once a year when LaSalle makes the trek out to St. Louis. So maybe he'll grace the Gola with his presence one of these games. But we should throw in, because of the beauty of part of this conference being close together geographically, we're going to head down to the Robins Center the next day, see Richmond take on Fordham. So any listeners from the DC or Richmond area, if you have any bar eating recommendations for us, please reach out. We would love to find some good places to go. But that takes us into the other huge game of the weekend, which ironically was at the Robins Center. VCU blowing out Richmond. It ended up as a 12-point game. It was kind of at that level for most of it. VCU slammed down the pedal midway through the second half and then basically lost all those gains when the bench guys came in. But it really established VCU at the top of this conference. If there was any questions after they beat Dayton, it's clear now that they're top three. They're sitting in first place themselves, tied with St. Louis. And I guess really the big question coming out of this, should the Rams be regarded as the favorite now?
I think that's a very real possibility. And let's not forget VCU's other game of the week where they beat UMass by 28 at home. This is the hottest team in the A-10 right now. They're tied for first place with St. Louis, and they're showing no signs of slowing down. I feel like every year I convince myself that Richmond isn't a good matchup for the Rams just because they're always disciplined. They don't turn the ball over a lot. I feel like after years of playing in that rivalry in that Capital City Lumber Liquidators Classic, that Chris Mooney is going to figure out how to get the ball across half court. And year after year, it just doesn't happen. VCU has owned the Spiders, and it happened again this week.
Well, and the one time they did hold on to the ball was in DC last year. That's why
Yeah.
they won in the conference tournament. I looked this up the other day during the game, so my mind is a little rusty on the exact stat, but I think they turned the ball over 9 times in that game against VCU. That's remarkable, and that's why Richmond ended up in the NCAA tournament. They turned it over 16 in this one, and Tyler Burton himself had 6. Jason Nelson had 3. When your two best guys, your steadiest hands on your team, combined for almost double-digit turnovers by themselves, it's tough to beat anybody, especially a team that in VCU is starting to actually play some really good offense at this point.
Yeah, I think we need to take back some of our criticisms of the Rams early in the season. They're still the number one 3-point shooting team in conference play. They made 8 more in this game against Richmond. And they
Schreiber was
also,
only 2 for 5 this time.
yeah, yeah, it wasn't even just him, though. I mean, it's the other guys. Watkins made a couple threes. So overall, too, they rebounded really well, which isn't typical of VCU this season. They're just firing on all cylinders. And at the halftime of the Dayton GW game, they had a little segment talking about how you should consider betting on VCU to win the A-10. And at the time on FanDuel, you could get them at about 3-1. Those odds have dropped off quite a bit with the Dayton loss. But I don't have an issue if you want to call VCU the favorite, or if you want to call them the favorite, they're playing the best, and it's not particularly close. St. Louis is playing well too, but they just haven't been winning as convincingly.
The craziest part of this game, I don't believe this has happened all season. And we talk about how we were down on VCU a few weeks ago. Well, I just never expected a game where Ace Baldwin, Jaden Nunn, Brandon Jones Jr., and Jameer Watkins would all score in double digits in the same game. You go back into the non-conference, and most games it was one, sometimes two. And nobody went off for 20 or anything. They didn't need to in this game. But VCU's biggest problem against Temple, against Jacksonville, against Duquesne, they couldn't get multiple guys actually scoring on the same night. And just to see all of them playing at least decently, Watkins was probably the best. He was 5 for 8 off the bench. He is actually playing very well in that role, like the guys over on the Black and Gold fan podcast pointed out, he's playing well in that bench role. And the last thing I want to throw out for their offense, I think people are going to see the Shriver numbers and just assume that they have to come down. They'll come down a little bit because no one can shoot 50% from three over 2 months. But that whole Richmond game, he just kept getting open. Like these are not particularly difficult shots for a guy of his skill level. He's getting clean looks at the hoop.
Yeah, he is. And it's just encouraging too in that Richmond game, where I feel like early in the season, we would see VCU occasionally go on runs, especially where they force turnovers and get out in transition a whole bunch. But they would also go through these huge dry spells where they can't stop turning the ball over, just aren't getting good looks. But they pretty much scored consistently throughout this game. And on KenPom, even though men's college basketball still hasn't moved to quarters yet, that's how they divide it up in the box score. And the Rams put up 15 points in each 10-minute segment of the game. So they just consistently had a good game plan all night against Richmond on the road. And yeah, I mean, Shriver's still playing great, but it was all the other guys too. It was a collective team effort.
Yeah, and if that team effort on the offensive end continues, then I'll go ahead and say that they are the favorite because the defense, I mentioned after the Duquesne game, they were down by VCU Mike Rhodes standards. It was one of their worst defenses of his era coming out of that game. It's starting to tick back to what it was. They're forcing turnovers again, and it's starting to seem like what Duquesne was able to do to that team is a little bit more of an asterisk than anything. They had a great game plan. VCU couldn't turn them over, and the Rams are playing great coming out of there. The Dukes, not so much. So that was one of the other games I wanted to touch on here real quick. Duquesne losing to Fordham. Both defenses played out of their minds until the last 5 minutes when Duquesne just got eviscerated. Fordham ended up with 42 points in the second half and a half where they were struggling to score again. The biggest takeaway for me coming out of this game, because this was a Duquesne loss more than a Fordham win, and Keith Dambrot basically kind of said that in his press conference that they should have taken that game and it was offensive execution that killed them. The Dukes went 3 for 16 from three. And it was the first time in A-10 play where the vicious Fordham defense that we saw last year in a non-con play felt like it had come back, where they were just hounding guys on the perimeter. And I think one of the biggest reasons is that they're playing Will Richardson a lot more. Started the game, played 23 minutes, and they have more polished guys up top, but he is the best athlete of their guards, and it helps them a lot defensively.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking with regards to Fordham's defense. It hasn't been as sharp this year, but it was reminiscent of what we saw last year. And coming into the game, one of my concerns for Duquesne is just how well Fordham defends the 3-point line. They give up the fewest threes in the conference right now, and that perimeter defense was strong. I wouldn't expect Duquesne to have another game this year where they only make 3 3-pointers, but that just made it tough to overcome. And down the stretch of the game, too, it seemed like it was mostly Cody Moore just tearing the Dukes
He
apart,
was
getting inside.
amazing in the final minutes.
So, yeah,
He's waking back
disappointing.
up too after a rough stretch to start conference play, so.
Yeah, and overall for Fordham, too, this was a big week for them where came into the week at 1-3 and left with a pair of road wins. They also beat LaSalle. Or sorry, that was last weekend actually, so they had their bye, but starting to string together a couple wins and maybe getting back closer to the double bye race. I don't know. We'll see if they're a team worth talking about in this segment, but back to 500.
They're 3-3. I said at the outset of conference play, they felt like a 9-9 team, and they still very much feel like a 9-9 team to me.
Yeah, we're on that trajectory. But any other highlights from the week that you wanted to talk about before getting into the overall standings and maybe what teams we can expect to see rise up over the rest of the season?
It needs to be mentioned what St. Bonaventure did this week, just shellacking Duquesne in the first half. and then just kind of holding on in the second half. I mean, it's tough to maintain your focus when you go up by 20 basically right off the bat, but they didn't let the Dukes get back into it. And then they go on the road to Loyola and we're basically never in it. So the Ramblers get their first conference win. St. Bonaventure goes to 4-0 at home in the conference, 0-3 on the road. Their only win outside of the Riley Center was in the state of New York over a Notre Dame team whose coach is now retiring.
Yeah, Mark Schmidt to Notre Dame. Should we start those rumors? They're going to be looking for someone soon.
If this was like the 2 years ago Bonaventure team that made the tournament, and Mark Schmidt kind of had like a signature addition to his resume this season, I think that actually could happen. But Notre Dame's not hiring a mid-major coach who's coming out of like an 18 and 13 season or whatever they're going to end up at.
I mean, that's almost precisely what Villanova did, but different
God, actually,
circumstances.
they have too many road games left to lose only 13, so.
Yeah, that is very alive that Bonaventure could lose all of their away games. But I feel like across the
And win all
league.
their home games. I want to make it very
Oh,
clear that
it
those
could
both could
happen, yeah.
happen.
It could. They get Dayton at home. That's really the only. Yeah, the rest of their home schedule actually isn't that bad. I'd say the next hardest game is GW at the Riley Center. So if they get past Dayton, 9-0 is a pretty legitimate possibility. But so with that, looking at the standings overall, going into the season, pretty much all we talked about was how Dayton, St. Louis, and BCU were the three teams that could really make some noise, the three that would separate themselves. And although the non-conference didn't go as planned, that's kind of what's happened in league play. Those are your top three teams. And at this point, would you say any one of them is in danger of potentially slipping out of the top four? Or can we pencil them all in for double byes right now?
I mean, regardless of the Dayton loss this week, I still feel like the talent will just carry them through to somewhere near the top. The way that VCU is playing at this point, I can't bring myself to say that they're going to drop off. I don't know. As St. Louis, like, they haven't played the toughest schedule as of late, so I'm nervous to say that they're in a great place, but they're at 6-1 right now. And they're
Best
so
start of
much
the
better
Ford
than
era, too.
everyone below them. Like, I'm sure as hell not going to bet on the Billikens dropping out. And by the way, their next two games, they're playing Davidson and Fordham. They're both on the road and they have the belt curse, but like this team could be 8-1 pretty reasonably going into a Friday clash with VCU. So.
And even if they split those next two games on the road, the Billikens would be in pretty good shape. So I pretty much agree. I feel like these three teams are safe, which means that if that holds true, there's probably four, five, maybe even six teams fighting for that last double bye spot. And it really feels like that fourth place could be as wide open as it's ever been in the A-10.
Right now, KenPom has a four-way tie for that spot at 10-8. GW, Richmond, George Mason, Duquesne. Bonaventure one back. Fordham, St. Joe's, Davidson two back. So yeah, there's a lot of teams that can take this. I guess I'll kick it off. I think I still would pick Richmond here. And everyone's gonna run away because of how badly they got beaten by VCU, but I still feel like they're just the best of this crew. Largely because of Burton. He's such a great ceiling raiser who's going to win you some games. Now, granted, James Bishop right now is in a pretty similar spot, but this is the best defense Chris Mooney has had since the Sweet 16 team. All the pieces fit extremely well. And I think on any given night, you can get a big performance from a Bigelow, Roach, Quinn, Matt Grace, any of these guys are capable of stepping up in the moment. Their problem against VCU is that it was the rare night where none of them stepped up. But as they just keep playing lesser teams, throughout conference play. I think they find a way to get themselves over that 10-win mark, somewhere around 11 or 12. And if it comes down to it, one thing that could be really helpful, they already have the tiebreaker over Duquesne, who plays that pretty weak schedule throughout the rest of the year. And that could be the difference. Now, granted, they don't have, or as you say, they've lost to Mason, but they play Mason again. So they have a chance to get that one.
Yeah, I think Richmond, if I had to pick one team that's the most talented out of this group of teams that still has a chance, I think it's them. Just the concern overall, though, you mentioned that they have a number of players that on any one night can step up. We saw what happened when it didn't work out against VCU. And right now, Burton is second in the conference at 19.9 points per game. The Spiders don't have another double digit a game scorer. Jason Nelson's just under 10. They have Neil Quinn and Bigelow hovering around 8. And in particular, with Jason Nelson, he's really followed a similar path to Malachi Smith's freshman season, where it started out amazing, was having these great games, and kind of hit the mid-season wall where he's only at 6 assists through 7 conference games, and he's turned the ball over 18 times over that span. So he hasn't been playing as well. Neil Quinn's had a couple big games, but he's just not as consistent of a scoring threat as Grant Golden used to be. And I just wonder, I know Burton is going to single-handedly win the Spires some games, and you could still make the case he's the most talented player in the league. I just wonder how many nights there's going to be where he doesn't get enough help.
Yeah, and some of the other threats here, GW is probably playing the best of any of these teams right now. I still just don't trust the defense, although it's
It was
been a
good
lot
against
better in
Dayton,
conference
but
play ever since that Loyola game, the opener, where they got torched by Tom Welch. But there's so many question marks. Like, this basically comes down to, can Bonaventure win on the road? Can GW continue to consistently play good defense? Is George Mason good? Like, on paper, they still look great. Oduro's playing out of his mind at this point. The defense is still just as good as it's been all season. And yet, they are still doing weird things, like losing at home to GW in a first half where they got throttled. Like, there's still just no consistency to the Patriots.
well, I think another problem too with George Mason, they might have the toughest schedule out of these middle of the pack teams. They still have to go at VCU, at Dayton, at
So does
Duquesne,
Richmond,
and
though.
at Richmond. Yeah, but I mean
Yeah.
that's a lot of tough games coming up. One thing though encouraging me with the Patriots, you mentioned Oduro playing great, and he's leading the league in rebounding right now in conference by averaging just under 19 points a game. But aside from him, the Patriots are starting to get contributions from a few of their lesser known guys. Malik Henry has been a huge boost off the bench right now. He's had a 15-point game against Loyola where he kind of saved them with Oduro in foul trouble. Had 12 in the Davidson game. And as bad as he is shooting the ball, he's really good at getting to the foul line. And then the other guy, too, Justin Fernandez, has suddenly gained the trust of Kim English. He started the last three games, and although it hasn't come with a bunch of scoring, he's still a super talented young player. And if he hits his stride in the second half of the season, that could be another big boost for George Mason. So overall, they've kind of expanded beyond these seniors and grad transfers and getting more guys into the mix that can contribute. So I'm interested in Mason. I just wonder if the schedule's going to be too difficult.
After last year, where they kind of had their own Iron Man 5, and then the beginning of this year, where their bench was an atrocity in November, they're like weirdly very deep now, especially once Tickett Gaines gets back from his injury. But my biggest hope for them was that English would start playing one of their two super talented freshmen, either Fernandez or Devin Dinkins, some big minutes here, because they're really the lone ceiling raisers that this team had. And he's in, like you said, he's entrusted Fernandez. He's a guy that I could see getting extremely hot in February, maybe sneaking onto an all-rookie team the shot's not falling yet, but he passes every piece of the eye test as an athlete out there. And the wildest thing about this team is after last year, where it felt like they were just dead if Oturo was in foul trouble, they have three legitimately good centers now. We didn't even mention Ginika Ogiako, who's kind of bouncing in and out of the starting lineup right now, but they're physical and deep at the center position.
Yeah, they are much different than last year. But I guess just for the other teams, so last week, I think you still had Duquesne as one of your double bye picks, a lot due to their weak schedule the rest of the way, which is extremely favorable. Are you scared off after this last week, or is Duquesne still a legit contender?
I'm tentative. And one of the biggest issues is the fact that they've now fallen behind in the loss column to Richmond and Mason, two back at GW. We're going to learn a lot in the next three games for the Dukes. They play Loyola at home coming up, and then at UMass at GW. They need to go out and rock Loyola after the last two games they've played. And then in what I would describe as a semi-tough back-to-back, because at this point, all road games in the A-10 are tough, you got to split with UMass and GW. Duquesne's only road win the entire season is still against St. Joe's. Now, granted, their losses are Kentucky, Dayton, Richmond, St. Bonaventure. That's a tough slate. But they need to go out and prove that they can beat a mid-tier team on the road and do it pretty convincingly. Because we can't say with confidence at this point that they can just go 8-1 at home. The Fordham game and the New Mexico State game have shown us that they're too capable of a bad clunker in that building every once in a while. Someone's going to get them.
Yeah, I mean, 8-1 at home would be a very tall task, but I guess that raises another question. Out of this mix of teams, we talked about how KenPom projects a whole bunch of them to go 10-8, a few at 9-9. What does fourth place end up being? Is this going to be 10-8 like it was in 2018, or does someone get to 11, 12, maybe even someone else
11.
With 13?
You're not getting to 13. It's not even that none of these teams are good enough, although I'm pretty sure none of them are good enough.
No, they're not.
But there's just not enough gimme games. Like, does anyone feel good about going into Philly right now? Like, as much as LaSalle and St. Joe's have struggled, St. Joe's can light you up at any time. And LaSalle's just going to keep playing their asses off until the end of the season. They're probably the least talented team in the conference, but Dunphy has them playing so hard every night. And it's just a pain to play them. If you want to go to Kingston, maybe it's the night where Freeman and Leggett both go nuts at the same time. Like, as bad as, like we've said over and over again, the top is not what it should be or what it normally would be, but the middle to the lower end of the middle is stronger than normal. There's just a lot of decent teams this year.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I guess last question on the double bye race. There's two teams that going into conference play, we were pretty high on after the non-con. They've both struggled hard in January, and that's UMass and Davidson, both sitting at 2-5. Can we write them out of the double bye consideration, or is there any chance that one of these teams goes on a run? I would say probably not, just simply because UMass is, they've probably been the worst team over the last 3 weeks. They've been getting blown out ever since their huge win against St. Louis. And at this point, I just don't have the confidence in them figuring it out. And Davidson just can't shoot. And a Davidson team that can't shoot can't win against good teams, period.
So let's say the number is 11. That means for either of them, because they're both at 2-5 right now. You do the math, that's 9-2 to close out the year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough task for anybody. Like, I'd be impressed if St. Louis or VCU goes 9-2 to close out the year. Davidson, you can actually look at it and say that their losses are all reasonable. At VCU, at Mason, at Dayton, home for Dayton and Richmond.
Davidson has had the
a lot of tough
schedule
games
so far. Yeah.
This is also a team that lost at home to Charlotte and then lost to Delaware right after and lost to a terrible Northeastern team the next month. Like everything I talked about with the consistency issue with Duquesne, do we trust Davidson to always clean up against the bad teams? I sure as hell don't. They just haven't shown us enough at this point. And UMass, you better tell me right now if Fernandes is going to play all 11 of those games for me to believe they have any chance. Because without him, they're just not anywhere near a double high caliber team.
No, not at all. And that's just been a concern how he's been in and out of the lineup. They look pretty good most of the time when he's in there, but I think that was one of our concerns going into the year is outside of Fernandes, how would their guard play be? And we have pretty quickly found out over the last five games it's not good.
It's not. And something else is not good in UMass right now. And
Oh.
that's the tension between the fans and the coaching staff. And we'll close it out here. This is not a fun topic, but it's something that I think needs to be addressed here. For anyone who is not familiar with what happened, Frank Martin in his post-game press conference on Saturday after they lost to St. Joe's fired off and we will retweet the thread for anyone who wants to find it because it will take us 10 minutes to read off all the quotes here. Fired off about the criticism that his players have been facing online. And this is something similar that we heard from Anthony Grant the other day about Dayton players. Now, there was a little bit of a different angle. Grant's was largely focused on the fact that gamblers, seemingly unrelated to Dayton, were going after his players online after they lost to VCU. And if anyone hasn't heard that, it's a great succinct little minute from Grant, just basically stepping up to the podium and just saying how ridiculous it is that these people are just going after college kids. And it was a wonderful little moment of defense from their coach there. Frank Martin's was a lot longer and a lot angrier. But basically, in summation, it was aimed at the UMass fans who have been incredibly critical about certain players on their team and towards certain players on their team. And for anyone unfamiliar, the biggest refrain from the UMass fans over and over and over and over and over again this year is that they need to play their top 100 freshman Tafara Gapare more, and that the easiest path to those minutes is at the expense of Martin's son, Brandon, who has been starting at one of the forward spots. And you know what? They're probably right. Gapare probably does deserve some of the Martin minutes. And you can look at the stats. This team is 6-0 when Gapare plays at least 15 minutes. He's a huge ceiling raiser for a team that's struggling right now. But the simple fact of the matter is, the UMass fans will not shut up about this. It just keeps happening. They keep saying the same thing after every single loss. And I went into the UMass Twitter Spaces on Tuesday, and Curry Hicks Sage, who does a great job running these, mentioned it at the beginning, and he gave some great stats about it. And if that was it and we were done, that would have been fine, and he would have been a fan and someone who unprofessionally covers the team but does a good job of it doing his job. But the problem was we got 2 hours in and we're now on the 11th person saying the same thing, and it got irritating that the fans are so annoyed at this one player who basically his mistake, I say mistake in air quotations, is that he went to go play for his father. Because if he was at LaSalle right now, or pick any other mid-major school, he would be playing because he's good enough to be in a nine-man rotation at a mid-major level. And he wouldn't be taking the same crap because of the idea that his dad's playing him more because he's his son. Maybe he is. We'll never know that for sure. But Brandon Martin is a decent player who deserves to be on the court. Whether or not he plays too many minutes is up for debate, and it's a debate those people love to have. But hell, I feel bad for Brandon Martin. He's been taking crap all year. Like, so on that end, I get where this Frank Martin anger is coming from.
Yeah, I get it too. And I think the important takeaway, both from this, both from Anthony Grant's comments, other coaches too have spoken up. Chris Caputo echoed Coach Grant's comments after the GW game this weekend, how players can get attacked, and there's a line where a lot of people clearly go over it, and social media doesn't help things. Gambling probably doesn't help things. And I think that's just something important to remember, is that these are people and they do this for our entertainment. We enjoy the games. We care about the games. We want our teams to win and do well. And a lot of us have our own opinions on how that's best to be accomplished, and we're not always going to agree with the coach. But I think it's just important to remember you have to be careful what you say, especially when it's in public like this.
Yeah, and Frank Martin makes it clear he doesn't care about the criticism levied towards him. And that's a good stance to take because I think people sometimes forget the idea of criticizing this coach who's making millions of dollars or criticizing a professional athlete like the Russell Westbrook jokes are different than criticizing a 20, 21, 22-year-old kid. Like these guys are doing this because for most of them, they just love basketball. A lot of these guys aren't going to play professionally. I'm sure Brandon Martin actually will probably go into coaching, but I mean, these guys deal with a lot of crap. So if anyone's listening, and I feel like if you cared enough to listen to our show this long, you're probably not interested in the deep attacks on players. But if anyone's listening and has been feeling angry towards their players, hopefully you take it to heart that this is getting a little over the edge. And I'll even say myself, because ironically, I put out something that morning talking about some ideas of lineup changes that UMass should make. And obviously, when you say that someone like DeAndre Dominguez should play more, which I will continue to say because that dude is awesome. He is one of their three best guys, and he shouldn't be at 20-ish minutes a game. He should be closer to 30. But that's got to come at the expense of someone. And I proposed ideas of different players that he should take minutes from, whether it was Martin or Levesque or Diggins or Thompson. And so you have to go double-edged there. I doubt Frank Martin read my article, but if he did, and he felt like I was being critical and attacking his players, then I would hope that he would reach out to me personally because that's not my intent. So.
Yeah, I hope this whole thing wasn't about you because that was some
No, it
funny
was about
timing.
that Twitter Spaces on Tuesday
I
because that went over the edge.
I'm just
And
joking, but
Martin even acknowledged that he was on Twitter that night. And I would have to guess he probably had some sort of burner in that meeting.
I mean, it is kind of weird how certain coaches are very active on social media, and Frank Martin is probably at the top of that list in the A10 right now, where other coaches, like, I mean, Fran Dunphy, does he even have a smartphone? I don't know. But he's not getting in these Twitter spaces. Or Anthony Grant, not getting on these. So it just depends. And it's an interesting connection between the fans, the players, the coaches that we didn't used to have. But I guess all I would just say is don't make it personal, whatever you do. Like, it's okay to care, and it's okay to get mad when your team has a bad game and loses, but it's just important to keep it in perspective and not cross the line.
Well, and so, because it's Frank Martin's job to defend his players, because he's a college coach and he's brought these kids in to keep his trust, just like it's the job of Curry Hicks-Sage to keep the UMass fans informed. And it's our job to tell everyone when these things are going on. And so, there are definitely fans that are in the wrong, but we got to look at the other side of this too. And that's Frank Martin's actual comments. And anyone who reads the thread, I would encourage you to read it at least twice because the first time it comes off bad. And I think you agreed with me on that it sounds like just rantings. Once you read it through three, four times, you start to understand the point that he's going for. But one of the weirdest things is that he directly calls out his team's fans. And one of the quotes that really stuck with me. There's some people that have opinions on social media that I've dealt with personally already. And believe me and them will have a man to man when the season is over. It's really weird that a coach is basically going after specific fans in his fan base. Like, in the end, you do need to play nice with your fans a little bit and make them like you, whether you think that they're out of line or not, because that relationship still has to be enough to make you sell tickets. And that part to me was just a little odd. It felt like he was definitely venting some frustration. And I think there's an extra layer that it's not just his players, but that one of those is his true flesh and blood. But it was weird. And it definitely came off a little angry. And I don't think the UMass fans are going to take this very well. And so I don't think this story is even close to being over.
No, I'm curious. Let's see, does UMass, so they're at home against Richmond this week, and we'll see if the 1,300 in attendance reacts. But I do think, just like there's a line for the fans, I think for the coaches, like there's a little bit of a difference between protecting your team and attacking the fans. And at the end of the day, Frank Martin's role at University of Massachusetts, it's a lot different if there aren't fans that care about his team and attend these games. So I think you make a good point where I don't know if he handled it the best way. I think it's great. Like, I'm sure his players appreciate him stepping up and giving them a voice that they don't easily have themselves after these tough games. But I think both parties could have said things a little bit better here.
Yeah, things are a little messy in Amherst right now. We'll see how this plays out, though. If there's still this level of tension at the end of the season, it's a very bad thing for that program going forward. But we've seen Martin smooth things over on social media with people before that he thought were going after him. But our pal Ghosty got blocked temporarily until Martin was informed that all he was doing was just one big joke. And those two made up. So we'll see what happens here.
Yeah, that would be the best ending to this situation, but we'll see.
Yep, and that does it for this episode of the Three Bid League podcast. Thank you guys for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please be sure to give us 5 stars on iTunes, leave us a review on there, or reach out to us on Twitter at the Three Bid League Pod. You can also send us an email at the number 3bidleague@gmail.com. We're about a third of the way through conference play. Brooklyn is on the horizon. Let's all enjoy this week, and let's hope for a lot of points when GW meets St. Joe's.